This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanison and Noel Lim. It's 6 o'clock in the morning on March 11th, Friday Junior, by which I mean Thursday. This much closer to the end of the week. How are you doing today, this morning, guys?
I have a slight headache, but I'm sure I'll get over it. Yeah, with your lovely company.
Yes, we are. We will magically make the headache go away by virtue of our sparkling company.
Yes, I'm sure.
Oh, you know, in the same way that if you have pain somewhere, you inflict pain on another part of your body to distract yourself from that.
Are you talking about yourself?
Maybe. Who knows? But hey, oh, maybe we're better than paracetamol. Who knows, right? Good. It's a Thursday. And Thursday is always my favorite day because it's Ring Incense Day. And today I will be speaking with a licensed financial planner advisor, Annie Hall, on basically empowering women financially. This was actually, I'm looking forward to this one because there's always this narrative that not enough women are getting actively involved in their finances and particularly investing. So I'm going to just ask her how she's talking her clients through this situation, how she's guiding them. And I think this will be a great conversation, not just for women, but for anyone who is hesitating or to enter the financial world.
And I think this was in conjunction with International Women's Day as well, which was this week, right?
Earlier this week. And, you know, BFM did a bunch of programming. I was trying to look for a more eloquent word to say. But we did a lot of programming on Monday, talking to women in business, tech, all sorts of things that were predominantly male-dominated for so long, and getting their perspective on it and taking a look at different issues as well. In fact, we had the Breakfast Grill. On the Breakfast Grill, we had YB Hannah Yeo on, former Deputy Minister of Women's Affairs, to come and give us a lay of the land of what's going on. Mm-hmm. You can find all these conversations and more on the BFM app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
But as for Ringgit and Sense this morning with Annie Hall, that'll be later on at about 9:30 a.m. So be sure to stay tuned for that, or you can find the podcast later today. In the meantime, though, what are we talking about in this next hour, guys?
Right. So 6:30, as usual, we will cover some international news, and we are looking at Biden and his stimulus package. Huge, $1.9 trillion, bigger than the Malaysian economy. And also we're looking at Myanmar as well. Looks like things are getting more dire there.
Yeah, and I've got an article that we're going to be talking about in about 10, 15 minutes. And this is, I guess, related to non-fungible tokens, because a blockchain company bought a Banksy screen print and then they burnt it. So we're going to talk a bit about that and the future of tokenization, I guess.
If you want to weigh in on those conversations, remember you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we're going to be talking about the democratization of storytelling. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Waiting on a War by the Foo Fighters, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. So this morning, the first subject that we're tackling is quite an interesting one. It is the democratization of storytelling. And if you're wondering what that means, well, a good example of it would be the short film Hair Love. So this is the winner of the Oscar for Best Animated Short in 2020. And what's notable about this short is that it started out life as a Kickstarter project. And its director raised $284,000 and $284,058 to be specific, from Kickstarter in order to produce this animated short. And while Kickstarter films are not unusual, the fact that this one won an Oscar is certainly it's a landmark for this type of storytelling. So it does raise a lot of questions about what the future of filmmaking and storytelling would look like.
I mean, we're starting to see accessibility increase, right? Because the walls are coming down, distribution has changed, and also access to the equipment you need. You can pick up an iPhone and start shooting videos and things like that. And filmmakers online are using this kind of equipment, simple stuff, to get started and build up over time, right? And one other example, Lynn, and this is a bit more of an indie feel, I think, not really indie feel, more of like an online feel, is the reimagined short of Bel Air, which is basically reimagining of the French Prince of Bel Air. And this was by filmmaker Morgan Cooper in 2019. And I remember watching this back then, and I was like, sign me up. I want more of this.
It looked really cool.
I want it now. And I'm very happy to see that Peacock, which is the subsidiary, the streaming service of under NBC, I think. Yes, NBC is the one with the Peacock logo. So yes, this is correct. they've ordered 2 seasons of this reimagined Fresh Prince by Morgan Cooper. So this is very interesting, right? Because Morgan Cooper was, not the most famous of film creators, even online, but this caught the attention of Will Smith and team, and they flew him out to the set when they were filming Bad Boys for Life and kind of got the ball rolling. So you're essentially seeing this landscape changing, but also with the lower barriers, you're also seeing high-flying individuals get involved as well, right? I think, on the back of the news of the week, which is the Oprah interview with Meghan Markle, I mean, Harry and Meghan have their own Spotify channel as well. They've got deals with Spotify and Netflix. The Obamas have got a deal with Netflix and Spotify as well. So you're seeing all sorts of things changing. The distribution is evolving.
Yeah, so democratization is certainly happening, and you have a recognition by the elites, right? The Academy Awards, and who knows, the BAFTA too may start to recognize some of these stories told by individuals on a bootstrap budget, right? Because mm-hmm. the tools are very very cheap, right? It's not expensive, and good stories don't need to be expensively produced. And always, you know, I'm a sucker for all these ads, right? All these video ads. And one that always stuck in my mind was the Johnny Walker ad, where I just saw 2 boys walking what looked like might be the Scottish Highlands. And then it just had a very memorable ending. But the point was...
It was a story.
I think they were just wearing clothes from their cupboard. They were actually 2 college students who won the mm-hmm. prize for Johnny Walker. It was such a beautifully produced ad, black and white, I think. And so it can be... It's very memorable, and it's not expensive. And also... this brings me to the point, I guess, for people like us who work in a media company, just to borrow a phrase from Bill Gates, where he said, people need banking, but they do not necessarily need banks. So it's the same, right? People need stories. They thrive on, you know, consuming stories, but they don't need media companies like us to tell them stories, right? But why you might still go to a media company, especially an established one, is maybe you want to get some credible information, some, you know, like real correct information, or, you know, if someone like a guest who wants to appear on a show, they want to borrow the credibility of a media company. So what media companies would be left with is not necessarily their storytelling abilities nor their content archives that they have, but rather it's their independence, which is going to be their main asset.
Or also the scalability of what they do, right? Because end of the day, yes, you can go create a short movie on your own and put it on YouTube and things like that, but you're not going to be able to create the Avengers, right? You're not going to be able to create a huge blockbuster. And that changes the landscape of cinema as well. They've got to become bigger because streaming is changing the game on that front, right? So a cinema's got to be an experience. You've got to go into a IMAX theater or a theater with the appropriate sound equipment to feel the movie as opposed to mm-hmm. just consuming the movie. And that's the pressure that's being put on the big blockbusters as well. Especially after the last year, they've not had a great year, right? Streaming has really boomed on that front. But, you know, you look at the equipment that we have in the palm of our hands today. Yes, we can complain about how expensive the iPhones have become and things like that. But the cameras on these systems are remarkable. You're able to shoot 4K, 60 frames or 30 frames per second on your handheld device. Yes, you're not going to get the same level of depth and quality, but it's a really good start.
Yeah, and just speaking about that, Roshan, you do something on Sundays, right? Every Sunday. I mean, you just put a camera there and then you talk to someone. I mean, it's your own show, right? In your own rights. And Chuang also, our colleague in the other team, I mean, he does his own shows too on YouTube. And Ezra, ever since he left us, he has his own Ezra Zayed project show.
Yeah, he's doing some interesting stuff. It's been quite fun.
It's quite exciting, I think, to see what opportunities have opened up, because now that technology is so freely and readily available, you know, a lot of us do have smartphones, and they may not necessarily be as high tech as the latest iPhone hot off the press, but they're oftentimes they're more than serviceable to put out a fantastic product, right? Because our association for a long time, I think, with movies or films that had been shot on the iPhone were those terrible grainy quality, like first-person videos, like I'm thinking of Cloverfield, you know, that you slightly give you motion sickness.
You're also thinking about like a decade ago.
Yeah, exactly. It's been a long time, and things have come very far. And it means that creators who may not necessarily fit the mold of larger established media companies don't necessarily have to enter that closed ecosystem in order for their product to be seen by the masses. Mm-hmm. You can screen test it effectively with millions of people online, and then you get that authentic audience reaction, which you can then take to the studios to say, hey, look, my concept really does work. You know, you wouldn't have thought so, but
as opposed to back in the day, it being in the hand of the executives, all the focus groups that they did, which were very skewed to the locality which they were in right? So when you, it is very, very interesting. And even on a personal point, when the I find that when it comes to the democratization of content, it really comes to relatability. Mm-hmm. There is always going to be a place for big media companies and more professional outfits, but the localized personality comes with relatability. And I find that my own posts that are more personal and relatable, or are lessons learned or common or mistakes I've made, are the ones that resonate more. And that's really what people want, right? They want a form of relatability in a world that often feels a bit too far removed.
Indeed. If we take Hair Love, for example, Hair Love is a short about a father doing his daughter's hair. So, you know, you kind of can't get more relatable than that for, I think, a huge segment of the population. But do let us know what you think about this. Do you think that storytelling will become increasingly democratized in future? You can WhatsApp us at 01878988899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got some messages coming up, and then we're looking at the relationship between blockchain and art. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Help Me by Joni Mitchell, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. So perhaps some of you can help me understand this.
You should ask the person who chose this story.
So the story that we're looking at this morning is on the back of a stunt. A blockchain company bought a piece of Banksy artwork and proceeded to set fire to it. But instead of destroying the value of the art, they claim to have made it more valuable because it was sold as a piece of blockchain art. So this is in relation to something called the non-fungible token. Roshan, perhaps you'd like to tell us what that is.
Non-fungible tokens. Okay, so this is basically technology based on the blockchain, right? And what it is non-fungible means you can't copy it, and there's a limited amount, which is a problem when we talk about digital properties, because we can copy, right? The perception is if I send you a file, I'm sending you a copy as opposed to the original file. Now, the blockchain is supposed to have fixed this by making it, I'm sending you the one I have. I'm not giving you a copy of what I have. I'm giving you the original. So with this Banksy artwork that they burnt, essentially they made a video of the moment, and they put it on the blockchain and created a limited amount. So that there is a limited amount of NFTs here. So there's only 15. Right. So that immediately creates value. And if you want to own that moment, then you buy the token. I know it sounds like gibberish. It really is. I'm still trying to grasp my own understanding of this completely. But it is essentially a demand supply situation for limited edition items. Right. That's what it is. But on the internet, on a digital platform where it cannot be copied. And that's always been the concern before this. And everyone seems to be jumping on this. The NBA is selling NFTs of highlights to its audience. So you can own that moment. But even if you go into the mechanics of it, there are certain rights like, oh, the video doesn't belong to you, but this particular recording of the moment belongs to you. So there are a lot of technical issues here that really need to be ironed out. But essentially what it is that people are looking at ways to make limited collector's editions online. That's what it is.
Yeah, so what I understand about blockchain art, there are actually two ways to go about it. The first way is that you have the physical art or the installation, and then you create a digital token, and that becomes the proof of the artwork, mm-hmm. right? It's another, but just put in a digital platform. And then you can sell this digital token, or you can sell the physical art. And this may be very useful for art pieces that are actually very old now. We have centuries old art, and there's be one way of preserving its longevity if the art loses its, you know, the quality.
Its integrity.
Yeah, but you can still have like a digital token, so to speak, that's, you know, so we know the ownership, the provenance and all that. That's a proper record of it. Then the other one is the Banksy art, which was burnt. And then, so from physical art, now it becomes a digital token. So I'm thinking to myself, wow, I could have placed the Banksy art on my living room, but now I have a token in my computer.
I do believe that the burning of it is a stunt, right? It's meant to garner attention.
Yeah, it's meant to show what it means that we are doing a digital
token. And it's also showing just how limited now it actually is, because the physical art piece is now gone. It's like how in the old days when the value of an art by a particular artist would rise after the artist passed away.
Right. So you can't recreate that moment anymore. Like it's done. You can't recreate that particular burning of the piece.
Yeah. So
you got to think about it like the original and then that print, right? Mm. So the original Monet artwork maybe is the original physical form. But if you create a digital token from that, then you're creating prints of it essentially. All right. It's not the original. I know. Everyone's brain's about to explode. Yeah, Lynn looks like she's about to punch me in the face.
Yeah. So blockchain, you either, you know, it's keeping a record of the provenance, or the other thing is about Banksy, how you put it now in a digital token. And it has some novelty factor, right? Because it can be sold on auctions and there's a lot of digital tokens right now about some blockchain art. But they, at this point, I think might be quite low quality kind of art. But I'm a bit, a bit two minds about this, right? I mean, I do enjoy art, right? I don't buy them, but I do enjoy them. It almost feels like a token versus a nice piece of art in my living room.
The critical difference here is this, right? Do you want to own this limited token, essentially? That's what it comes down to. Anyone can go to a gallery and view an art piece. Why do people buy art pieces? Because one, maybe they want to show off and be like, hey, look, I have this beautiful Monet in my room. But also there is a population of people who are okay with copies of photos of that picture on the internet. They don't need to have it. They don't have to own it. So there seems to be a
No
movement.
Doubt there is a market for it, right?
Yeah. A market and a movement, right? Whether it transcends, whether it applies to everyone, who knows, right?
Yeah. Another thing I just want to say, the burning of arts, though, I think you need to get the artist's approval.
Yes.
Because it's disrespectful of the artist.
Yes. So this is something that I think is going to be really interesting to see how this develops. The idea of burning art in any art form is very anathema to me. But then, hey, you know, maybe I'm just old-fashioned that way. Let us know what you think. Would you buy art as a digital token? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We are heading into the 6:30 news, and to take you there is the Human League with Don't You Want Me, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Jack White with I'm Shaken, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanisin and Noel Lim. So right now we're taking a look at what's been happening around the world. Of course, we cannot get away without looking at the US, because we've had some big news. The $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill has passed the US Congress. So this relief bill was aimed to help Americans deal with the impact of the pandemic. This was its final hurdle, and it was approved 220 to 211, pretty much along partisan lines, I believe. So no Republicans voted in favor of this bill.
Yeah, I think the GOP is arguing that the job market has recovered enough to warrant little or no new stimulus spending, although I think that's pretty much politically impossible considering the campaign that Biden ran and the feel on the ground, right? So here are some of the major pieces from this legislation. It extends the $300 per week jobless aid supplement and programs making millions more people eligible for unemployment insurance until September 6th. The plan also makes individuals' first $10,200 job in jobless bet. It basically is there is a tax-free element to it. They're increasing the tax relief or the tax. They're reducing the taxable income bracket. The bill sends the $1,400 direct payments to most Americans. The checks started to phase out at $75,000 in annual in income. That's been altered. They also expands the child tax credit for 1 year, increasing it to $3,600 for children under six. And there is way more right here, including $20 billion being put into the vaccine manufacturing distribution. So this is a big move, not just for supporting people on the ground, but for the I guess, for the US's fight of the COVID-19 pandemic overall.
Yeah, like you mentioned, there is also money for the vaccine, the $20 billion for vaccine manufacturing and distribution, along, I think, something like $50 billion into testing and contract tracing. I think the Republicans were calling for more expenditure on the COVID-19 fight, but this is what has been set. But just looking at the COVID-19 situation in the US, I think more than 32 million Americans have been fully vaccinated, either receiving two jabs or the single dose jab from Johnson & Johnson. And Alaska has become the first state to expand eligibility mm-hmm. for all its residents above the age of 16.
Yeah, so the situation in the US is quite dire, but this is also the single most expensive bill in US history. And after, I think it was five relief bills, this is on track to be the first one passed by strictly party lines. So it's going to be interesting to see how this is implemented as well. Also just turning our attention to the other country that's been in the news quite a lot over this past month, which is Myanmar. So Reuters has an exclusive where they spoke with a Myanmar policeman who fled to India after refusing orders. So according to this policeman, he was ordered to shoot at protesters with a submachine gun in order to disperse them at the end of February, and he refused twice. So he and six others of his cohort refused orders by one of their superiors, and they felt that they had no choice but to flee the country as a result.
Yeah, Reuters reported that around 100 people from Myanmar, mostly policemen and their families, have crossed the border to go into India, and several have taken shelter in the neighbouring district, and Reuters interviewed three nationals there, and they also cited their police IDs. I think, I guess people have a heart, right? And according to police rules, protesters should either be stopped by rubber bullets or shot below the knees. But now it seems like they are getting a different kind of instructions, quite a violent one.
Yeah, and not to add more bad news on top of this, I've got the CNN website opened up, and they're reporting that another official from the ousted Myanmar leader, Aung San Suu Kyi's party, has died in custody following alleged torture. That's the second such death while in detention of junta forces this week. And this is according to a watchdog group. So, I mean, yeah, this is, I think there are really no other words to describe or really talk about this.
Yeah, I think journalists also will probably start to leave the country because they have to work in exile in order to continue reporting, because otherwise they will also be a target.
Yeah, so we don't, in this region, we don't have a very good track record when it comes to retaliation against journalists as well for covering these kinds of very fraught events in countries. So this is very tragic and unfortunate news coming out of Myanmar. So we'll be watching that very closely. Another quick piece of news in the tech stage: a group of hackers say they've breached a massive trove of security camera data collected by Silicon Valley startup Verkada Inc. So this apparently has gained access to live feeds of 150,000 surveillance cameras inside hospitals, companies, police departments, prisons, and schools. And some companies even had their footage exposed, including carmaker Tesla Inc., Cloudflare Inc., which is a software provider. And it also, according to a Bloomberg report, hackers were able to view videos from inside women's health clinics, psychiatric hospitals, even the offices of Verkada itself. So this is, on the surface of it, there perhaps was initially some amusement from me when I read this article, but then as you continue to read, it is quite alarming.
These are the kind of headlines that scare me. These are the real, because end of the day, yes, Internet of Things and all that is great, but if your security is not up to snuff, these are massive systemic issues that the concentration risk here is just way too high.
Yes, so do let us know what you think about the stories that we've covered this morning. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. We are looking at our own local papers and portals next, so stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, that was Little Lies by Fleetwood Mac. And you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. 6:49 in the morning, Thursday, the 11th of March. And we are looking at our local papers and portals to bring you what's happening on their front pages. So The Star, their front page is a golden milestone. So this is actually to do with The Star Media Group, which launches its 50th anniversary celebrations today. So congratulations to them. 50 years is indeed a milestone. Another piece of news on their front page is PM secures extra hard quota. It's a story that's continued on page 2. So this is on the back of the fact that Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin is on a Middle East tour right now. And the Saudi Arabian government, after meeting with them, Saudi Arabian government has agreed to give Malaysia an additional 10,000 places on the Hajj quota. So that was quite the high note to conclude his official visit in Saudi. I think now he's in the UAE.
Yeah, some quick headlines here over in Malaysia Kini. Apparently, UMNO sees no hurry in pressuring PAS to take sides in its split with Bersatu, while its advisor Tengku Rozali Hamza says that even a pact with Pakatan Harapan in G15 may be possible. However, UMNO Vice President Muhammad Khalid Noordin says the party should focus on working with people on the ground instead of wasting time on political polemics. So essentially, just the continuing fluidity around all these party politics going into the next election. But speaking of that, though, this is particularly interesting one, because it seems that PKR insiders have told Malaysia Kini that the party may field its Permatang Pau MP Nurul Izzah Anwar to challenge former Vice President Zuraida Kamarudin in Ampang. Although no final decision is reached on this, this could be a battle of heavyweights, former PKR versus up-and-coming PKR. Oh, actually, to be fair, Nurul Izzah was already a high-flying PKR member until she decided to take a back seat to focus on other things. So that would be an interesting one to pay attention to. But just shifting gears in terms of stories for a second, the front page of the Malaysian Reserve goes with pandemic magnifies income disparity, targeted aid needed. And this is essentially citing the Gini coefficient value, which has increased from 0.399 in 2016 to 0.407, signifying greater inequality. Yes, the Gini coefficient is not the best or most comprehensive indicator of inequality, but it is one factor here. And Malaysia Kini has another story about how one phone serves six family members. And essentially, you know, earlier we were talking about the democratization of storytelling. Mm-hmm. This is the flip side, right? Yes, people have access to phones, but there are still so many families who struggle with one phone within many devices. And this, a lot of old, low-income families face this in the remote working world.
Yes, the digital divide has certainly been exacerbated during this pandemic time. Noel, you highlighted earlier some interesting things out of the Sina Harian this morning.
Yeah, so I'm looking at their front page. So they ran a survey together with Sin Chiu, and they got something like 24,000 respondents who took part. And there was a survey on what the respondents felt about the handling of the economy, the handling of the fight against COVID-19. So just to quote some figures here, 37% on the lead, 37% said that they were not satisfied. In fact, they were extremely not satisfied with the performance of the government, and followed by 24% said they are not satisfied. So 37% extremely not satisfied, 24% not satisfied. So that is like the majority. And then another thing, in terms of top five ministers whom respondents were most impressed with, well, take a guess who is on the lead.
I've already seen the graph, so
well, Soalan Bocola.
Yeah, Soalan Bocola slightly.
Just to sound smart, I'm going to say Khairi Jamaluddin.
Yes, you're right. So that's 10% of respondents.
At least I was honest.
Yeah, they like Khairi, so he's on the lead, followed by Zulkifli Al-Bakri, who is the religious minister in the Prime Minister's department. And then Ismail Sabri, 7.13%. And then followed by Zafrul, Minister of Finance, 6.6%. And among the five, the lowest is Muhyiddin at 6.25%.
That's quite interesting to me, actually, because it's quite a
It's quite a broad group. And there are people who have been, of course, very visible during this COVID-19 pandemic. You know, the finance minister, the COVID-19 coordinating minister, the senior defense minister, as well as, of course, the PM. And you wonder whether, you wonder why it is that out of all of these people, Muhyiddin is coming in kind of behind them. Is it because of the emergency order? Is it because of the, he's always the one that announces the MCOs. Is that kind of an association that has been built? Or is it because that if you look at those top five, the other four weren't really involved in the original kind of fall of the government very much as compared to him?
It could just be the perception that they're doing a good job, right? In terms of their portfolio specifically, because Khairi is responsible for bringing in the vaccines and distribution of the vaccines. Ismail Sabri is responsible for making sure the country kept going on.
Yeah, so
and the finance minister is making sure that the budget keeps going.
Yeah, so I think they you know, there's probably a combination of factors. So the mention of an emergency, well, the respondents, 63% of them said it was not necessary to declare that emergency. Only 30, and the balance 30-something percent said, yeah. So, you know, obviously a lot of people didn't agree with the emergency.
Very interesting setup in the Sinaharian. Do check it out if you have the time. Right now we are heading into the 7 o'clock news bulletin and then more business news for you. Here's Wild World by Mr. Big to take you into the news. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.